Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to episode 163 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
I'm Rebecca Linlin from Rebecca Drives.
And Dan is off busy doing battle with a server this evening, so he won't be joining us. Rebecca, you've been driving a bunch of stuff since we last recorded. Why don't you start off?
I have been driving. It was very exciting, actually. So I went on two media events last week. The first was the 2021 Subaru Crosstrek. This is actually it's a vehicle that I really have liked for a long time. I think it's a great size. It kind of falls in that like compact crossover. It's still five passenger, and it's you know, not the roomiest thing, but it's such a great city car if you want to have that off-road feel. And it's probably going to handle some of those potholes in this many cities better than other vehicles for sure. But this one they consider it fully redesigned. It is on a global platform now. But it looks familiar, which I like. Like, you're not going to look and say, what the heck did they do to the Crosstrek? They just dialed it up a little bit. The interior is really, really nice. They did a great job on the interior. It also has a new engine. There's two engine options, actually. One is a 2.0 liter with 152 horsepower. The one that I tested was a 2.5 liter, 182 horsepower, so 30 more horsepower. The lower engine, the smaller engine comes in a 6-speed manual, and then the upper engine is an automatic, which is what I tested. Of course, all Subarus have all-wheel drive to them.
And at least in North America.
At least in North America, yes. This one has 1,500 pounds of towing capacity and 8.7 inches of ground clearance. And years ago, soon after the vehicle came out, actually, I actually wrote about some of the best vehicles in a post-Hurricane Sandy world. And the Crosstrek was actually my number one pick because it got really good fuel economy and it had really good ground clearance. So it was especially of note when I looked at that. Fuel economy was about, combined, you're going to get about 27, 28, 29. It's rated at 29. And I would say I got somewhere pretty close to that driving through and pretty aggressive driving actually through the hills of Virginia. So it was lovely to be back on the road, and it was the flight was maybe a third full. I did have to go to JFK, fly out of JFK to Dulles because they're not doing the Delta shuttle out of LaGuardia anymore. So hopefully that will come back. But Delta did a really, really good job. They have, you know, all the middle seats are empty if you can, and if not, this was a 2-2 setup on a CRJ 900. So, but again, there was 15 people on the flight. there was 14 people on the flight down and 15 people on the flight back. So it was pretty sparse. But back to the car. So overall, I just think, you know, the Crosstrek is just one of those just comfortable, fun, urban vehicles that does a lot of things really well. It has really nice athletic refinement. It was quiet on the road. I did have it up to about 50 on some of the gravel, the soft gravel roads, and I slammed on the brakes just to see what would happen. Nobody else was around. It was an easy thing to do. And that thing stayed so straight and true. It really made me feel good about, you know, being on the road in this thing, because there was clearly some really nice torque vectoring going on. And it just settled right in. Like, it was like, okay, this is what we want to do. We're going to stop here right now. And I loved that sort of that feeling of confidence that it inspired. Of course, there's an absolute ton of accessories that you can get. There's this really thick rubber liners that come in with the cargo area, and then you can actually get them on the backs of the second row seats. So if you put the whole entire seat down, you have this floor with a heavy rubberized floor, basically, so that you can put all sorts of gear in there.
So if you're regularly carrying big stuff, you can have a protected surface there.
A big or wet stuff,
okay.
Right? So you want to throw a damp daisy in there? You can, you know, which is great. And it was, you know, short money. I mean, the list of accessories was very long. And they're all, you know, $100 here, $200 there. They're not trying to gouge you. So, and you can really personalize it on the Subaru site. When you go to build the Crosstrek, you can really pick and choose.
Are those things like dealer installed accessories or, you know, things like
the
rubberized?
For the most part, you can order them. Yeah, you can order them with the vehicle. Okay. And then you can add them after as well.
So something like those rubberized covers, yeah. Is that something that's easily taken out if you,
absolutely.
If you didn't want? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. It comes with the cargo bay area comes with the rubberized mat, and then the back of the seat mats, they just kind of click on.
Okay.
They're like hooked in there. So it's almost like floor mats. Okay. You know, you can interchange them very easily. So the base on this is $23,295, and that includes $1,000 of destination. And then as tested, mine came in at just over $29,000. And that includes destination. So, you know, I did the Limited, which is the top of the line. They also had the Sport there, which I think is a little bit less expensive. Sorry, let me just get some water.
Yeah. That $23,000 and change price, you know, for the base price, you know, for a car that's standard with all-wheel drive is actually pretty reasonable. I think it'd be hard-pressed to find another all-wheel drive vehicle for much less than that.
Absolutely. And you know, we talk a lot about pricing on, I think that we're all, you know, pretty practical and frugal in many ways about.
Try to be.
Well, we try, you know, yeah. There's an occasional, we're not going to turn our noses up at anything, but I think that, you know, when I look at what you're getting for $29,000, I think that's just, it's fantastic. It really is. And I should correct myself. I actually got 26 miles per gallon in aggressive driving is what I wrote in combined.
So standard Rebecca driving then.
Standard Rebecca driving, exactly. But, you know, I just, obviously Subaru has, you know, a great legacy, kidding. But, you know, they have a great history of, you know, animal welfare and environmental awareness. They do have a vegan option. So they have leather seats, and then they also have a vegan option that actually is free of chlorine, of PVC, of, you know, obviously animal products and such. So, which is a nice touch. Like, that's something that, you know, is important to, particularly to a Subaru buyer. And so they acknowledge that, they celebrate that, and they do offer a vegan option.
And, reference Daisy, who you mentioned earlier, you know, she proudly wears her Subaru dog tag that I got for her at the Chicago Auto Show every day. I
mean, yes,
it's on her collar.
Awesome.
Every day, so
that's awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, if you're in that market for that compact crossover, I mean, this is really, you know, I feel like the Subaru Crosstrek is really the perfect either college car, if you can afford it, or post-college car. Because you're still going to be hauling stuff around. If you're like most college kids, you're still going to be hauling stuff around. You're going to be throwing stuff in there. Your friends are going to be moving. You're going to be moving. You know, it's that kind of just really good where you've got the utility that you need, but you don't feel like you're hauling around a bunch of car that you don't need if it's just you driving. So
it's the
so
modern equivalent of what I had in college. You know, when I was in college, I drove an 84 GMC S15 pickup back when compact pickups were actually, you know, compact, and they were dirt cheap, you know, and, you know, today, if you want a you know, anything close to that, you know, the closest you're going to get is going to cost you, you know, $30,000 or more, yeah. You know, and oftentimes upwards of $40,000 for, you know, for a smaller pickup. And so, yeah, you're right. You know, something like this, you know, is the perfect kind of vehicle for, you know, a college student or a recent grad, you know, where you are moving around, you've got, or, you know, I mean, anybody else that, you know, needs to haul stuff around, you know, I think it's got a decent amount of cargo space in there.
Yeah.
With the seats down, right?
It does. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a great empty nester vehicle also. Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about it for that flexible lifestyle that people have, you know, after when, you know, like you and your wife, like, you know, but sometimes kids come home or you need to do stuff. Like, it's just, there's just the right amount of cargo that you need. You're not going to be moving an entire apartment in this thing, but you are going to help a friend out with it. And again, what I love is that it's the cargo and the flexibility is there, but you don't feel like you're hauling around too much ass when it's not there.
Yeah. It's big enough to take a couple of pieces of IKEA furniture. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It does come with EyeSight with the Subaru.
Is that standard?
So a lower version, like a base version, is standard, and then you have to bump up to get the full complement of safety features, which is unfortunate because, you know, we always like it when they try and include as much in the standard package as possible.
Well, it looks like EyeSight, at least the basic version of EyeSight that's standard, does include adaptive cruise control and lane centering.
It does. And that's so new for them. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that was previously an extra cost option. So now you get it on everyone.
Yes, you do. I always like to see, and I apologize. I knew this last week when I was working on my review, cause I always like to see whether it has the blind spot monitoring or the rear cross traffic alert. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the things that you have to upgrade to. So,
So
driver assist technology, it's standard on the Sport and Limited, which is actually all they had us drive. And then the lower trim levels, the base and the premium, it's optional on there. Blind spot detection and rear cross traffic alert is optional on premium and Sport, but standard on Limited. The Limited that I drove really had everything in terms of options that you could get. But, you know, overall though, they've got a lot of safety features. Obviously, you know, daytime running lights, they've got the rear vision camera on there. But you do have to, you know, again, I would love to see like blind spot monitoring included in that, but
yeah,
at least it's an option.
Yeah. At least it's good that it's available, but yeah, I agree. That's one that should be part of the standard package for everybody.
Yes.
And, you know, for those not familiar with EyeSight, I can't remember if we've talked about it before, but, you know, this is a little bit different from a lot of the adaptive cruise control systems. Most ACC uses a radar sensor, and then you also typically have a camera as well for the lane keeping assist. And the radar sensor is used to measure the distance to the car ahead of you. EyeSight is a stereo vision camera, so two cameras. And they're using the parallax between the two cameras to try to get that depth perception. And I've found that it generally works pretty well, surprisingly well. But, you know, it's, you know, obviously like any camera system, it's going to have limitations in bad weather or, you know, fog, when you probably shouldn't be using AC cruise control anyway.
And I will say that one of the things, so the two cameras that you referenced, they're on either side of the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. And that makes the casement for the rearview mirror very large. Okay. In that windscreen. So when I first got set up, I noticed that the front A pillar was quite narrow, which actually it turns out that there's high strength steel in there. So that was cool. Cause they did that. They were very conscious of the fact that pillar needed to be narrow, and that that impedes my visibility because I sit so close to the car. But then out of my right eye, the corner of my right eye, I was like, what am I seeing? Well, this is so weird. And then I realized that it was one of the EyeSight casements. So it was something that once I knew it, it disappeared, but it was definitely distracting at times. And again, I think it's more just because I sit up close that I was very conscious of it. And after a while, it didn't bother me, but it is important to know that, you know, that you do have to kind of look at that.
It's a larger package. It's a larger package than what you have in most cars. Cause you know, so most cars, you have a single camera and that package is usually, you know, above and in front of the mirror. So the mirror, you know, is between you and that package with the camera in it. And it usually doesn't extend out beyond the sides of the mirror. So, so it's in an area where it's not generally going to impede your vision anyway, because the mirror's there. But because those cameras need to be farther apart to in order to do that depth measurement, that package is inherently larger with the EyeSight system than it is with ours.
So that, and that makes sense. So they do have to have a certain width apart.
Yeah.
As you say it, to get that angle. Okay. Yeah. So that was the only, and again, it's in no way, shape or form a reason not to purchase this vehicle.
Right.
You know, it just, again, it's just, you know, I always like to talk about things that I just notice when I'm driving. And it was kind of just something that I thought, what is that? But overall, I was really, really happy with this vehicle. It was just, you know, it was just such a good, solid car. And again, for that price point, for under 30 grand to get a fully loaded, because that was the limited, you know, that's just, I mean, that's just serious. The Sport Track is $26,495. The Limited is $27,995. So, you know, you're still, I mean, just to get into that range, I think it's just a fantastic vehicle to get that all-wheel drive, to get those, you know, a good Subaru Boxer engine out of it, to get decent fuel economy, you know, and those safety features. It's just, there's a lot, they packed a lot into that vehicle.
Yeah. Now all they got to do is stuff a WRX engine in it. You're perfect. Or an STI engine.
You know, it was surprising though. It had enough pep. I would have obviously loved to have had a manual, but they did a good job with it though.
Yeah. You know, 185 horsepower, whatever it is, you know, is plenty for almost everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So what did you have after that when you got back?
So after that, I actually drove another off-road vehicle. I got the chance to drive the brand new Land Rover Defender. And I'm not going to lie, I kind of jumped up and down in excitement when they invited me. I will be the first to admit, I was a last minute add. And ironically, the reason that they had a spot was because one of our friends, Brian, couldn't go. And the reason he couldn't go was because he lives in Maryland, and the state of Maryland is on the quarantine list.
Oh, so you got to be quarantined for 2 weeks when you come to New York.
Right. But I actually saw him at the Subaru event, which is how we did this math. And at first I was like, wait a minute.
So he infected you and then you infected everybody else.
But fortunately, I came back early from Virginia because I was done, and I was like, why not just come back early? Which is a good thing, because if you're in a state less than 24 hours, you don't have to quarantine. So I was in Virginia for 23 hours. So on to the Defender. So the Land Rover Defender, it's back in the States. I think it left in 1997. It was actually only sold in the States for a few years. So they're very rare and they're incredibly collectible, and they go for outrageous sums of money for these really stripped down vehicles. But so the new Defender's back. They started production back in January, got interrupted by COVID. They were able to deliver vehicles in June, and now there's about 2,000 of them on the road. But the media is just getting a chance to drive them because everything's been on hold. So we were driving the 2020 Land Rover Defender 110. There are six different trim lines in the 2020. There's actually seven in 2021. But the SE I had was kind of in that middle trim line, which is actually really what I prefer anyway. I like that. I've always kind of bought in that range. So the base price is actually $49,900 for the base Defender. The version that I had was $71,000. It had about $9,000 worth of accoutrements on it, mostly related to the extensive off-road that we ended up doing with it. you know, the Defender, when you look at it, it's pretty square, frankly. As it should be. It does harken back very much to the design. The front of it, you know, we talked a lot about the Bronco really looking so much like the Bronco. The front of the Defender kind of looks like it. It sort of echoes it a little bit. Certainly the silhouette is more representative of traditional Defender, but you still know what this thing is when it's on the road. So I had so much fun. I was hard at work. Believe me, it was very hard work. We picked up in Jersey, drove up to the Land Rover Experience Center up in Manchester, Vermont. So at first, when I saw we were going to Vermont, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. But it's actually just about 3-hour drive. So it was interesting because we were initially just on the highway with the thing. And then, you know, which was a good experience because you think of these vehicles as just being off-road, but it was actually incredibly well-behaved on the highway. Even though it has this appearance of being very high, it has 3 ride heights that you can adjust manually, or, you know, with a button. So I put it in access mode and then that let me get in easily enough. And then there's like the normal travel mode. And then when you're off-road, you can raise it up another as high as 5 inches from the access mode. So you definitely can tell the difference. But on the highway, it didn't ride tall. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You know,
Does it have air springs?
Oh, you asked me these engineering questions. I don't know.
Okay,
like it does.
Okay. Go ahead. Continue. I'll look it up while you talk.
Okay. I believe it does. I know it has a variety of differentials. The rear differential, the center diff, and then the front. It doesn't have a front diff, I believe.
Okay. It's got an optional electric air suspension. So, yeah.
Okay,
that's what allows you to have the varying ride heights.
So
you can get coils or air springs.
So mine probably had it, and I apologize for the shuffling paper while I grabbed the. I thought I had my Moroni here that they gave me. I don't. So once on the road, then it was really quiet, and this thing's got, you know, big fat tires on it and stuff like it. It shouldn't have been as good on the highway as it was, but they did a really nice job with it. So we drove it up there about a couple of hours. And one of the things I noticed, the seats were incredibly comfortable. They have this really nice surrounding bolster kind of feel to them. And I had the 14-way heated and cooled seats. And you could get exactly, you could say
14-way heated and cool. So is that like 14 different settings or?
No, 14-way.
A 14-way adjustment and they're heated and cooled.
Okay. And heated and cooled. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. 14-way and heated and cooled.
Okay.
And so I was able to, you know, get it exactly how I wanted it to. And the cool thing was that the way that you, instead of having extra buttons for like the climate of your seat, you can actually access it through the dial that you set your temperature. So you set your HVAC temperature and then you press it again and that becomes your heated and cooled settings as well, which was really clever. Like it's a nice use of a dial. So it's multifunctional dials that actually then when you're off-road, they do other things as well. So the inside is very clean and these dials have multiple uses, which is really cool to take advantage of the technology that they certainly didn't have the last time this vehicle was anywhere around.
Yeah. Well, the last Defender was, you know, designed, you know, in the wake of World War II.
Yeah.
And it was basically unchanged for, you know, 60 years until it finally went out of production.
Exactly. This is all new. It's better.
Yeah. You know, and the thing I like is it's not in any way a retro design. You know, I mean, in terms of its, the basic profile, it's, you know, obviously, you know, very reminiscent of, you know, the classic Defender, but you look at this thing, it's thoroughly modern. There's nothing retro about it.
No. I mean, it's a very, very modern interpretation, but it's recognizable also. And actually for 2021, and it's funny because we're sort of in this weird time warp because they're like, you can't even build 2020s anymore, and yet that's all that we had available to drive. So on the website, it's all 2021s because that's what ordinarily would be coming out now. And but we're just getting a chance to drive it, so we're like 6 months behind everything. So on the 2021, on the base, the 110 Defender, they actually have an option for steel rims, like
Oh, nice.
really stripped out, right? Which is awesome. So they had this almost, they didn't mean it, but it almost ended up being a soft launch for the 2020s, and now the 2021s are really going to have some cool stuff. They're coming out with a cloth roof, and there's talk of doing some really special things with this iconic vehicle. They gave us a book about it that's like almost 2 inches thick, and it just filled with just the history of this vehicle. So
But can you take the doors off?
You cannot take the doors off and you can't take the roof off, but that doesn't mean that you won't be able to at some point in time.
Oh, okay. So they've seen Wrangler and seen Bronco and decided, okay, maybe we need removable doors.
I think at some point we may see this really being able to be as stripped down as you want it to be. They as I said, that on the base one, they're going to have the steel rims, but then they also have this Defender X, which has all the same off-road capabilities, which we still have to get into, but is very luxurious inside. So they've the one that I had, that SE, was a nice balance of a leather and cloth interior, all the features that you could want, and but more durable. It had more hard plastics than you would normally expect from Range Rover, from Land Rover, but that's because it's supposed to be a more athletic,
More
outdoorsy
rugged
experience, right? A much
lifestyle
more
vehicle.
rugged lifestyle, exactly. So we got up to what they call the LRE, the Land Rover Experience Center. And I should clarify, those are open. So there's only three in the US. There's one in Vermont, there's one in Palm Springs, and then there's one, oh, it just went out of my head as my cat walks in. And these things, anybody can go to them. They have vehicles that you can use there. You don't need to be a Land Rover owner. So if you just want to get better at going off-road, they have the most incredible instructors that were so good. They were positive and constructive, and just they were absolutely fantastic. So I actually want to try and go at some point on my own, because you can learn so much about going off road. I mean, it's amazing. And so that was just a really, really cool experience to have. So oh, North Carolina, of course.
Carmel is the one in California.
Yes, so there's one in Carmel, one in California, Vermont, and in North Carolina.
And
So we were
for those who
obviously.
live north of the border, there's also one in Quebec,
Oh, fantastic.
Montebello, Quebec.
Oh, nice. Perfect. Yeah. And again, the idea that you can go and you don't have to be a Land Rover owner was really, really cool. And I thought that was great information. If you want to learn how to do off-road, if you want to learn, from really, really experienced people. So
How would they feel if we turned up with a new Bronco?
They would probably be all over it. They would probably crawl all over
Say,
the
give us 5 hours with it first, and then you can go play.
Exactly. No, I think they'd be all over that. So this it has, as you mentioned, the electronic air suspension, these adaptive dynamics, terrain response, hill launch, low traction launch, any kind of off-road, sophisticated off-road capability that you need, that's on the base model. Like that's how they all come, which I think is just amazing. And again, the way that you access it is through these dials, and it all comes up on the screen. And what was just first your infotainment system suddenly becomes your off-road hub, and it's got three different cameras for the outside, so you can see exactly where your vehicle is. You've got different, you can do the selection right there. And then there's auto, which is actually primarily the only thing that we left it in. We did change it one time. We were going up a really steep hill that was, I should have asked the grade on it. It was pretty aggressive, and we put it in climbing mode, and it climbed up the hill for us, which was really fun.
Nice.
And then you take over, and then you, we turned around and we went back down the other side of the hill in hill descent control, which I will be the first one to admit, I have a really hard time giving up control, but you basically, all you have to do is steer. You don't touch the brakes. You don't touch the accelerator. But the reality is that that vehicle is going to drive that hill better than I can. And so by giving up control, I was actually safer. It was kind of a bummer and it scared me, but but it was good. It was a great experience. So we went, you know, there wasn't a lot of water. Unfortunately, we've had a pretty dry summer here. So we couldn't do the full on water fording that the vehicle can do. But, you know, overall, it's just, it's such a fun vehicle to take in that really authentic off-road manner. And then to turn around and have it so well behaved on road. I mean, we ended up having a COVID issue where we couldn't stay overnight in Vermont. So we had to drive an extra almost 50 minutes at the end of the day and then turn around and drive back again. So all told, I think I put about 500 miles on that car.
Wow.
In the course of 2 days.
Did you then drive back to New York afterwards?
So then, well, yes. So I drove from the headquarters in Jersey up to Manchester, Vermont, over to Saratoga Springs, New York, back to the Ellery in Vermont, then down to this town called Coxsackie, I think it is, to this amazing, fabulous, semi kind of camping hotel where we each had our own little cabin, and in upstate New York. And then we had about a 2.5 hour drive to the headquarters. But I actually stopped at home, which was super fun, to bring my media car home, showed my family, got a chance to, you know, show my mom and my sisters, my brother-in-law and my niece, and show them how the car goes up and down automatically. And that was a lot of fun. So then I drove to Mahwah, New Jersey, which is about an hour from where I live. And then I had to drive back home an hour. So it was a lot of driving. That was from early Thursday morning until Saturday afternoonish. But I gotta tell you, it was incredibly comfortable for a vehicle that is so good off-road, for it to be so well behaved on road. That was really, really impressive. It was impressive.
You know, that's an amazing thing, you know, that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years, really more in the last 10 years, I guess, is, you know, as these things have matured, you know, you no longer have to sacrifice, you know, having incredible off-road capability does not mean that you're going to be bouncing around, you know, when you're driving on public, you know, on paved roads, you know, it's
right.
You can have a vehicle that can do it all.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it was amazing. And with just the touch of a button or the turn of a dial, you know, that's what's incredible, is that the electronics that are available today are just absolutely phenomenal. And I, you know, I'm probably leaving out so much of what this vehicle can do, but, you know, we were climbing up rocks. We were driving through mud. We didn't have any snow, unfortunately, but it could certainly handle that. Next week, they're having a group of journalists out in that Carmel Valley area in the sand dunes. You know, it's just, it was incredibly capable. There was, you know, there's some of the vehicles were equipped with a winch that you could put on it, which they needed to use in other groups. Fortunately, nobody in our group got into that much trouble, but you know, you can just do a lot with these things. I think they each tow 7,500 pounds, which is, you know, enough for a you know, recreational vehicle or something like that. And you know, at the same time, got about 17 miles per gallon, but that includes all the off-roading. So I would say on road, I probably was got in the 20s for highway driving. And by the way, this thing is fast.
I'm going to assume that, the ones you drove were the mild hybrid, not the base version.
Yes, I was just getting to
So.
that. So there's two engine types. There's a 2.0 liter inline four, 300 horsepower, and there's a 3.0 liter inline six, that mild hybrid, 400 horsepower, 8-speed automatic. It did have a pretty transparent stop start that was very, very good. Just immediate power. I mean, it was, you could get this thing up there should you need to. It was really cool. It was a really, really nice vehicle. I mean, even after all that driving, I didn't want to let it go. I'm not gonna lie. I didn't want to let it go. I could have kept that one.
I can sympathize with that. What did you drive back from JLR headquarters?
That's my next week's car.
Okay.
But I am currently driving the Honda Civic Type R with the 6-speed manual transmission. And it's cartoon on wheels. It's so much fun. It's a riot. My only goal this week is to not get a speeding ticket because the last time that I had a Honda Civic, I did get pulled over. I didn't get a ticket, but I think I probably would this time.
Yeah, well, the last ticket I got was in a Type R
Oh, was it really?
on the media drive in Washington State. So,
Oh no.
yeah, but we can discuss that another time. Right.
So Land Rover's back
Okay.
and it's awesome.
Anything else you want to talk about driving?
Oh my gosh, this is like the Rebecca podcast.
I can certainly understand why you would want to forget the other one, but yeah.
The third vehicle, the vehicle that I actually drove to meet up with the Land Rover people in New Jersey, was a Toyota Avalon Hybrid. And this was a really, really good vehicle. And what was probably one of the more remarkable things about this was how many people stopped me to talk about the way that it looks. Because it's a really sharp looking vehicle. And this is in Greenwich, like where everybody sees everything. I mean, I was at the main Greenwich post office and somebody came over and said, "I got to look at this thing. What is this?" And I'd said, "It's the Toyota Avalon." He's like, "Are you kidding me?" But they've just done a really sharp job with this Avalon. It's a hybrid. It's absolutely terrific. I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. It gets 43 miles per gallon. That's what I got. I love the fact that I just kept forgetting that it was a hybrid because it's just that good. Like it just it's and you know, I'm always about the idea of if you're going to give me an alternative powertrain, I don't want it to be weird, and I don't want it to be something that is a compromise on the whole driving experience. And they just did a great job with this. I drove down to New Jersey with a lot of traffic, and the responsiveness was there when I needed it, and then the adaptive cruise control was very good with it. It just overall it was really good. So I was really, really happy with it. I'm glad that they made it in a hybrid, and I'm glad that it's not something that you have to compromise
Yeah,
about at all.
this is the same hybrid setup that is now in a whole bunch of Toyota vehicles, the RAV4, the Camry, the Highlander, you name it. Yeah, it's the 2.5
Ironically, I
liter.
don't think it's in the Prius, though, is it?
No, well, the hybrid part, the electric part, is the same, although I think with a little bit less electric power than what's
Okay.
in here.
Yeah.
And the Prius has a 1.8 liter engine. So
Oh,
these
this is
all
the
have it. It's a
2.5.
2.5 with in
Yeah.
all the other applications.
Yeah.
So
It had the eCVT, and I should have mentioned this about the Crosstrek also. That CVT was one of the best that I had driven. There was absolutely no whine to it. It was really, really good. This eCVT is also very, very good. It was really minimal whine to it, and it just, again, I mean, 43 miles per gallon without feeling like you're getting 43 miles per hour. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, without feeling you're compromising.
It's got decent performance. You know, yeah. I mean, it's not an exciting powertrain. You know, it certainly doesn't sound great. It's got the classic Toyota hybrid, you know, engine revs up, you know, you stand on an engine revs up to 3,500, 4,000 RPM and stays there while you accelerate, you know, but aside from that, you know, it's fine.
It's not a race car, right?
No, not at all.
I'm thinking back to my experience.
This is not the Toyota that won Le Mans last weekend.
Exactly. And I'm thinking back to my experience with the Prius just a couple months ago, where that was just, I felt like I was always compromising in that vehicle for the sake of fuel economy. Mm-hmm. And that's not the feeling that I had with the Toyota Avalon hybrid, is that I felt like that hybrid was a bonus as opposed to something that I had to tolerate.
I wonder how much of the attention it got in Greenwich is because of this massive grill that it has now.
I mean, certainly that was part of it.
I mean, it's a good looking car. I mean, you know, it's a sharp, you know, it's a nice, sleek big four-door sedan.
It is.
But it does have a monstrous grill.
It does. And the one I had was like a deep ruby red with all blackout on it.
I'm sure that helped.
You know, it's a head turner for sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is kind of fun then to have, and again, a vehicle that has such good fuel economy without having to sacrifice style and design and really, you know, on many levels, performance. You know, inside, the interior is really well laid out. I hate that Entune system. We've gone over that before. I was able to use Android Auto, though, so that was fine. And, you know, just overall, I think it was just a really good experience. If you want a sedan with a good amount of room to it and you want good fuel economy, 43 miles per gallon, I think this is a really good choice. So the one that I drove came in at just over 42,000. And it actually retails for, I mean, the base is about 39 and change for it. So, you know, a lot of safety features on it. I was really pleased with it. I think it was a really good vehicle. I enjoyed it. I had a good week.
All right. So I had a couple of cars that were quite different. First up, Cadillac CT4V, and I still keep wanting to say ATS-V every time I think about it, because, you know, it looks a lot like the ATS did. You know, this is the replacement in the lineup for the ATS. You know, the front, you know, changed quite a bit, but the rest of the shape of the car, it doesn't have that fastback shape that the CT5 does. You know, it retained, you know, closer to a classic sedan shape that the old ATS had. And, you know, as we talked about previously, you know, earlier this year, I think, you know, when they first announced the CT5V and the CT4V, you know, the V models now are not what the previous generation Vs were. Those are coming up still with the Blackwing editions. V now is, you know, more like what, you know, with BMW, what an M Sport is.
Okay.
Okay. So you kind of get the look, some of the look of what was a V, but you don't get all of the performance.
All the personality.
Yeah. And especially the personality.
Okay.
So let me start with the base CT4. I like it. You know, I like the size of the car. For me, you know, a compact sedan, you know, is a good size. You know, this is comparable to a 3 Series or, you know, an Audi A4. You know, so I personally like the size better than I like the size of a CT5.
Right.
Granted,
I agree with that.
You know, the back seat is tighter. You know, you're not going to have as much leg room in the back of this one as you do in the CT5. The CT5.
You have a corgi. Yeah. She doesn't need a lot of leg room.
That's true. That is very true. You know, the CT5, you know, has a much, much more ample back seat, you know, for carrying adults. The CT4, you know, is more, you know, kids and occasional, you know, for adults for shorter trips. You know, not that it's tiny, but it's definitely tighter than the CT5. You know, a lot of the rest of the interior, very similar, you know, to other contemporary Cadillacs like the XT6 and the CT5. Same basic infotainment system. You got the center dial as well. You know, same steering wheel. same issues that we talked about before with the XT6 and the CT5 with the volume and forward and back buttons on the right-hand spoke of the steering wheel being in the opposite positions of where they probably should be. What distinguishes the CT4V from other CT4s? You know, other CT4s have the 2-liter turbo that you find in a lot of GM vehicles, fine engine. The CT5 or a CT4V, just naming, it's just drives me up the wall. The CT4V has the same 2.7-liter turbo 4-cylinder that debuted last year in the Silverado. So this one has 325 horsepower, 380 foot-pounds of torque, and it's mated up with GM's 10-speed automatic. Surprisingly, for what is a pretty large displacement 4-cylinder, 2.7 is a pretty big 4-banger.
Yeah.
It's very smooth. No issues at all with vibration. This was not a shaker 4. This is not like the old days. For those of us of a certain age who may have driven the classic GM Quad 4 back in the late 80s or early 90s, that was an engine that liked to vibrate, especially the first generation before they added balance shafts to it. And that one was only 2.3 liters. This is a 2.7, so it's a big engine. Those are some big pistons moving around in that thing. But it doesn't vibrate. It's very smooth. No issue at all there. It does have a bit of a growl to it.
Good growl? No.
It's not a bad growl. But, the feeling I got driving this thing, and especially, for something that, from what I've become accustomed to over the last decade and a half with V-Series Cadillacs, especially going back to the CTS-V, the couple of generations ago when they first put the LSA supercharged V8 in there. But even the ATS-V with that twin turbo V6 that was in there, 440 horsepower, those cars were, they were exciting to drive. They were a lot of fun to drive. This one, it's fine.
Oh my gosh.
That is definitely not
what they were going for.
It didn't excite me. I don't know
crazy.
What it was. It just didn't excite me.
Was it a handling thing or was it just
no?
Just
the handling
power?
was good. The ride quality was good. It was responsive. It was quick enough, but there was just something about it that felt blah.
Wow.
And
that sucks.
It's a bummer. I think I would have rather had a regular CT4 where I didn't have those expectations that come with that V badge.
Right.
Because I think I actually would have been happier with that one. This one, it's very quiet. It didn't have, some of the NVH issues that I've complained about on some other recent Cadillacs. And
how
like I said,
the
engine
was it stiff?
No, the suspension was good. It was a nice balance of, good control, but enough compliance, over rough pavement that it was not annoying to drive.
Right.
It was just really, really okay.
It's like coming home.
It was
from
exceptionally
a first
okay.
First date and saying, "Oh gosh, Mom, I don't know. He was really nice."
Yeah. I like the way it looks. I like the way it feels around me. I like the size of it. And the packaging, but I think if I'm going to get something with a V badge on it, I just want something that little bit extra, that visceral.
Yeah.
There's nothing visceral about this car.
Right. It needs to have some kind of an emotional response that like makes that elicits some kind of emotional response from you.
And this one just didn't.
Yeah. It's interesting because we've all driven those kinds of cars where we're like, we're supposed to love this thing, or at least it's built for performance or it's built for something. And it's always disappointing when the car does not slot in there. Do you think that they're saving some for that Blackwing edition?
Oh, I'm sure they are. I believe the Blackwing is probably going to have that twin turbo V6 again. And that should be coming sometime early 2021, I think.
But as you say, but this engine, good grief, it needs premium gasoline. Like, it should be good.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's got it's got, you know, decent performance, you know, 325 horsepower, 380 foot-pounds of torque.
But that does it. But
it responds, but it just does it in a way that it doesn't elicit a visceral. I mean, it just, it's so smooth.
That's part of the problem,
there's nothing
though,
to it. Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing, is that you want to have some kind of an emotional attachment to this. Like, I don't mind if the suspension is a little bit tight. You know, like with the crazy Type R that I'm going to talk about next week. You know, when I picked that thing up, as I said, I had just driven over 500 miles. I was exhausted. And the last thing I really wanted to do was drive in a manual transmission, super, you know, high strung vehicle. But, you know, after a little while, I threw it into comfort and it was totally fine. And it was actually really, and that's the last time it's been in comfort. But you want to have that. You know, it was so fun to rev that engine up. It's so fun to drive it and to zip around in it. And that's what, even though this is a stately and lovely rear-wheel drive sedan, it still needs to have that response. You still want to have some kind of an emotional response to it.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, I think in a way, stately almost is, you know, the thing to say about that powertrain. You know, like I said, it's got a little bit of a growl to it, but not in a way that really excites you. It's not annoying, but it's not exciting.
And I'd rather have it a little almost annoying, right?
Yeah.
'Cause at least annoying elicits a response.
Yeah. No, and this one just, it just didn't do anything for me for some reason. I don't know why, which is really a shame. But, you know, the CT4V starts at $44,495. The total price on the one I had was $52,000, including $995 delivery charge. You know, it had the full suite of driver assist stuff, adaptive cruise, blind spot. It had really nice interior, the sangria leather with jet black accents, heated and cooled seats, massaging passenger seat, front seats. Although they don't have all the modes that this week's car has, but you know, we'll get to that next time. Heated wheel, heads up display, had all the good stuff on it.
Right.
I think I would either take the standard CT4 with the 2 liter or, you know, wait for the Blackwing, you know, because this one is just kind of a miss.
Well, and there's a big gap between the Sport and the V Series. I mean, it's almost $40,000 to $45,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're definitely paying for it. And it looks like on the premium one, you can get the 2.7 liter engine also for $40,000.
Oh, so is that an option on there?
Yeah, on the premium. Oh, okay. So you can actually get that same engine without the premium.
Okay.
Premium, I should say.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't recommend it. I think, you know, the 2 liter is a really good engine. And I would probably stick with that. It's probably not worth
that. That's fascinating.
The extra for the 2.7, but... So anyway, that's the CT4 V series. And then I swapped that for a Hyundai Ioniq Hybrid Limited.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So the Ioniq's been with us for a few years. Got a refresh this year, new front fascia, upgraded interior, bigger central touchscreen and, you know, redesigned screen, you know, area around the screen, you know, feels a little more premium than before. Still not, you know, hugely premium, but, you know, it's nice. And, you know, the Ioniq, you know, shares its platform with the Kia Niro. And, you know, it's a platform that was designed to be electrified across the board. So all the variants of the Ioniq and the Niro are electrified. The, you know, base setup is a hybrid. And the Ioniq Hybrid, you know, is really, you know, a direct competitor to the Prius.
You didn't have the plug-in version?
Not this time. I have had the plug-in before, which has 27 miles of electric range. So that's a plug-in hybrid. And there's also a battery electric, which as part of the upgrades this year got a little bigger battery and is now up to 170 miles of range.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And that's, that's a battery electric, that starts at $30,000 before the tax breaks. So,
right.
you can get that down in the low $20,000, $23,000, $24,000 range, as a full battery electric, which is a really good option. And 170 miles is enough for most, the vast majority of people for their driving.
Yeah, no, that'll definitely cover any number of days. Yeah. So am I thinking of the wrong one, that there was a limited availability?
The plug-ins, the plug-in hybrid and the battery electric are only available in ZEV states. So in California, okay, and the other states that require zero emission vehicles.
Okay. But
the hybrid is available nationally.
Okay. All right. I've only seen a couple on the road though. They're just not very popular.
Yeah. The Ioniq has not sold as...
Is it an availability issue?
No, I think it just hasn't been as popular as the Niro. The Niro sells about 2.5 to 3 times the volume of the Ioniq.
Wow.
Even though mechanically it's the same vehicle, same wheelbase, all the same components, but the Niro, is sort of a tallish hatch crossovery kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas this, is very clearly a 5-door, sleek, fastback, hatchback, very much in the Prius mold, but without the weird. I think it's an attractive car, but it's a body style and a form factor that the market has just gone away from in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why Hyundai has decided to move the Ioniq name to its new line of battery electric vehicles, in a couple of years' time. So that's going to be their battery electric sub-brand. This one's going to go away. But, in the meantime, if you're looking for something that is, roomy and reasonably fun to drive, it actually handles quite well, surprisingly well, nicely equipped. And really, really fuel efficient. Like, this thing is EPA rated at 55 miles per gallon.
Wow.
I got, that's combined. So 55 city, 54 highway, 55 combined. I averaged about 49 with it, which is more than acceptable.
Right. But you weren't hypermiling or anything.
No, I was
right?
I was not hypermiling. I was just driving it normally, the way I drive anything else. It's got a lot of equipment. A lot of driver assist stuff is standard equipment on the Ioniq, as it is on most new Hyundais now. It's got a 10.25-inch center touchscreen with built-in nav, wireless charging. For that's for the 30. Did I say the price? $32,310. This is the limited. So this is loaded. This has all the available options. There's no options available on the limited. Everything is standard equipment. You get 3 years of Hyundai BlueLink, Harman Kardon premium audio, the powertrain. It's a 1.6-liter 4-cylinder, mated with the Hyundai hybrid system, which is using their 6-speed dual clutch transmission and the motor in between the engine and the transmission.
I mean, it looks great.
It's a good looking car.
It does sort of look a little bit like the Prius. It's not as weird as you say.
It's got a similar profile to the Prius.
Right, it does. From the side, it looks a little bit more Prius-like. I will definitely want to drive this because it seems very, very competitive to the Prius. But it seems like you had a better experience where I felt like the Prius was just a constant compromise. That doesn't sound like your experience.
No,
this
there's no real compromise in this. The powertrain, is, very seamless. And because, it's Hyundai's hybrid system, rather than using a CVT, they use a conventional step gear transmission, in this case, a DCT. And some of the other hybrids, they use a conventional, now an 8-speed automatic or 7-speed in the Sonata hybrid. It feels much more natural. And very seamless. You've got Android Auto and CarPlay, the Hyundai infotainment system. I mean, we've talked about it before. It's a very easy to use system. It's a nice interface. And one thing that Hyundai always does really well is the displays they use for their touchscreens. Always really good, very high contrast, bright, no glare. And you can see them with polarized sunglasses.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of the Toyota and Nissan displays.
It's a really, I mean, it's the interior. I'm looking at a picture of the interior now, and it looks really nice.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, that's, and the fuel economy, that's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. So
yeah, no, definitely. I would love to try one of
this. So if you're looking for something very reasonably priced, like I said, starting at about a little over $23,000 for the base, the Ioniq Blue, and yeah, $23,200 is the base price. And even that's got, a lot of features on it. And then fully loaded $32,000.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And then does it qualify for any tax credits?
Not the hybrid, plug-in hybrid and the battery electric version do.
Okay. But of course, state, check with your state because they're not qualifying.
Yeah. So it qualifies for the federal $7,500 tax credit on the plug-in versions or for the battery electric. The plug-in hybrid, I think, is $3,500.
Yeah.
And then the, California and New Jersey and a few other states have their own incentives as well.
Right. Cool.
So definitely something worth taking a look at.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. All right. So in the news this week, let's see, where shall we start? Let's start with selling EVs in Michigan.
Yes.
Before we talk about a new EV. So, and there's about 24 states, I think, where Tesla cannot sell vehicles directly to consumers because Tesla does not use franchise dealers. We've got this system here in the U.S. and a number of other countries have similar systems where manufacturers don't sell vehicles directly to consumers. They sell them to franchise dealers, which are independent businesses. Those dealers then sell on to consumers. And they provide service and maintenance and everything. Tesla, when they started, they opted to have company-owned stores and not have any franchise dealers. The problem is franchise dealers have been around since the early 20th century. And, the owners of dealers, got, fairly affluent, and they were able to buy a lot of influence with state politicians, which got them laws in place that prevent manufacturers from competing with them, which, at the time those laws were passed, they made a lot of sense because, the dealers had made a significant investment in their dealerships and in equipment and tools and spare parts and everything. And they didn't want to have to compete directly with the manufacturers who could potentially undercut them on price. So places like Michigan don't allow direct sales by manufacturers to consumers. Some states like California have franchise laws, but for a new manufacturer coming in that doesn't have any dealers, they can bypass that and go and do direct sales as long as they don't have any existing dealers that they're competing with. So up until January of this year, if you lived in Michigan and you wanted to buy a Tesla, you had to go buy one in Illinois or Indiana or Ohio. And Tesla has been suing the state of Michigan for a number of years, trying to get that law changed. They finally settled with the state back in January, and they came to a compromise, and the state said, okay, you can sell directly to consumers. You're selling because Tesla is mostly selling online now. You can sell the vehicles to consumers, but the cars have to be titled in another state first. And when you do the transfer to the consumer, it has to be titled somewhere else. And then the consumer can bring it back into the state and retitle it in Michigan. So you'd have to, you'd get the car from Ohio or Chicago or somewhere, and bring it back and take it to the Secretary of State's office and get a new title transfer the title to Michigan and get Michigan license plates on it. The state legislature now has a bill that they're working on that would close that loophole so that no other EV manufacturer or no other new entrant can do the same thing. For some reason, it's targeting companies like Rivian, which, you know, has a tech center here in Michigan and employs, you know, some 750 people here. But you, if this bill passes, you won't be able to buy a Rivian in Michigan, you know, unless they decide to get some dealers. What do you think?
Well, first of all, those dealers can't even be owned by Rivian. So it's not like Rivian can set up shop. Like, it's right. not like just, it's not even saying to Rivian, you have to have a dealership. It's that you have to have a franchise dealership,
exactly.
Right? Which is not always ideal and really means that the manufacturer is at the mercy of this franchisee to represent their product correctly, mm-hmm. which is a big challenge because, you know, how many times has somebody gone into the dealership, had a bad experience and said, I'm never buying X brand again. Meanwhile, that experience was may have just been local to that specific dealership. The brand itself is still fantastic, but those dealers represent, they are the face of the brand. And it's really frustrating for manufacturers if they're having issues with their dealers, because then consumers have issues with the brand, but they don't have issues with the brand. They have issues with that dealer.
Right.
So, you know, but as a general consumer isn't going to.
But the
to
dealer is the face of the brand.
Exactly. Right. So you've got to get that dealer, you know, on point with what you want to say about your brand. And what's happened now, the idea that they're closing that loophole, that Tesla's still going to be able to operate without having dealers, but Rivian and Lucid and others that come in are not, they're going to have to set up dealers. That's just adding an incredible expense already to an already, you know, incredibly capital intensive environment like building a vehicle and building EVs in particular. So I think it's unfortunate that the precedent that was set with Tesla isn't allowed to carry out its legal course, because I think it keeps Tesla with a very unfair advantage. And so the playing field is not at all level and when it comes to the dealers. And so, you know, to have Tesla have this totally separate ruling that nobody else can take advantage of just doesn't seem really very fair.
No, I agree. You know, I think it would be better if we did something like what they have in California, where, you know, if a manufacturer has an existing franchise dealer network, fine, don't let them compete directly
right.
with them. But if they're coming in clean and, you know, they don't have any legacy dealers, let them set up their own shops. You know?
Yes.
And, you know, the thing about, you know, this question of company-owned stores versus dealers, you know, there's pluses and minuses on both sides. Neither one is a perfect solution. You know, the reason that manufacturers got franchise dealers in the first place in the, you know, early years of the industry is because, you know, once a manufacturer builds a vehicle and they ship it to the dealer owns that car now.
Right.
The manufacturer is no longer sitting on that inventory. As soon as they ship it to the dealer, they get paid for it.
It's considered sold.
Yes, it's for the manufacturer. It's considered sold. So they get that revenue right away, and so, you know, that it's good for the manufacturers for cash flow. You know, for dealers, you know, they get a markup on that vehicle, you know, and they get to benefit from other things like, you know, selling service and accessories and things like that. You know, and they, you know, they have relationships with the manufacturers through their financing arms to get, you know, financing for those vehicles and things like that. And, you know, they make the investment in the real estate, you know, the building, the equipment, the spare parts.
Being the dealer, the franchise.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's many millions of dollars
absolutely.
To do that. It's a significant investment
right.
to do that. And that, you know, the manufacturer is offloading that requirement onto another business to do that. So there's a benefit to the manufacturer that way. Yes, they're getting less of the revenue. You know, they're taking a hit, you know, because they're selling it for a wholesale price and the dealer, you know, has a markup on that. But they also aren't incurring that cost associated with actually selling the vehicle to a consumer.
Right. I do think that sometimes they will aid, you know, there may be some financial aid that they'll give to dealers,
Oh, yeah,
you know, and
absolutely.
again, it's a little bit different when you're starting from scratch, right? Asking a dealer to do a, you know, a $5 million renovation on a dealership or even a network of dealers, you know, can be very, very cost prohibitive. And oftentimes that manufacturer then will have to bear some of the cost to, you know, to get their dealers looking all the same or to get them up to the same standard or such.
Yeah, and you know, for example, Cadillac announced last week that all of their dealers, their 600 odd dealers, are going to be required to spend $200,000 over the next 2 years to upgrade to support Cadillac's upcoming electric vehicles, starting with the LYRIQ. You know, and that includes, you know, parts inventory, you know, tools, training, and also installing a DC fast charger on site. You know, so that's, you know, that's money that those dealers, those independent businesses, are going to have to spend in order to sell Cadillac's electric vehicles. You know, part of the reason why Tesla decided to do their own retail network is, you know, one of the challenges for automakers is getting their dealers to actually try to sell EVs,
Yes.
because, you know, there's this risk of having lower service revenue, because that's where a lot of their profit comes from, is on the back end, on
Absolutely.
service and accessories and things like that, not so much from the new vehicle sales. So, you know, the traditional manufacturers have often had a hard time getting their dealers to actually get the customers to go and buy a plug-in vehicle instead of a gas-fueled
Well, and
vehicle.
it takes longer to sell an electric vehicle to a customer, yeah, in the show within the showroom. And
Yeah,
so,
because you got to, you know, explain, you know, teach them all about, you know, how it works and everything. So it's been a challenge. And, you know, Tesla decided to bypass that with their company-owned stores, you know, but that also means that now, you know, for every one of their stores, they've had to invest several million dollars, you know, for a storefront, you know, and, you know, paying the staff and
and
setting up
breaking leases.
and breaking leases and you know, service departments, you know, and that's been a huge drain on Tesla.
Yeah.
You know, that's been one of their challenges, you know, in reaching profitability. So, you know, it's not, you know, it's having company-owned stores is not an easy solution, but if a company wants to go down that path, I think that, you know, they should have the right to do that if they don't have any franchise dealers that they're already competing with.
Exactly. Right. I agree. I think that they should have the option. If they want to do franchisees, that's fine. If they don't, though, to have that option, I think to have that choice, I think is important. I agree with you.
So, speaking of electric vehicles, as we record this on Tuesday night, tomorrow Volkswagen will be unveiling a new electric vehicle. We got a look at it today and a backgrounder. It's the new ID.4, which is VW's first purpose-built EV that's coming to the U.S. market. And it's also launching in Europe and other markets this fall as well. So, Rebecca, what did you think of the ID.4?
So I think that this is a really nice looking vehicle. It's sort of like it's actually very similar to, I think, in size to the Crosstrek, right? I think it's a
Yeah, I'm not sure
compact.
about the it's a compact crossover. It's actually exactly the same length, 180.5 inches as a Ford Escape, and about half an inch shorter than a RAV4.
Okay, so maybe it's a little bit bigger than the Crosstrek. Maybe it's more like the Outback size.
Yeah, I
Okay.
think the Outback is closer.
But you know what? I think it's so from the look standpoint, I like it. It looks normal. It doesn't scream, I'm an EV. Price point, $40,000, I think is really, really good. That is before the $7,500 federal tax credit that it does qualify for. I was a little disappointed in the range of 250 miles because I feel like 300 miles is sort of the preferred number, and
It's getting to be the preferred number. Yeah. I mean, right. Yeah, there's a bunch of other competitors in that price range, like the Chevy Bolt, the Hyundai Kona EV, the Nissan Leaf Plus.
Preferred by consumers.
Yes.
Preferred by consumers to see that a three in front of that number. And you're absolutely right. Most of the competitors
The Tesla Model 3 standard range plus is 260 miles. So, you know, it's not much more.
Yeah, but Tesla's always given a minute pass by consumers. We're talking about mainstream, you know, getting people to look at these things. But so that was the only thing that I was a little bit disappointed about. I was surprised that it wouldn't have a 3 in front of there. I love the fact that there's an all-wheel drive version available. Obviously, living on, you know, in the East Coast, Northeast, in the Northeast, we get snow. And so, you know, I think that there's an opportunity here to really draw new people into the EV space. I like the way that it looks. I think it's got a lot of good features to it. I think it's got a really good, you know, sophisticated battery pack to it and that range. And so, you know, I think overall, I'm impressed with it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is built on Volkswagen's new MEB platform. So this is their new electric vehicle architecture that they already launched the ID.3 in Europe. It went on, started deliveries to customers a few weeks ago. And, you know, the ID.3 is a roughly golf-sized hatchback. And, you know, the ID.4 is a, you know, compact crossover. There's going to be, I think, roughly 75 different nameplates derived from MEB over the next 5 years for VW's nine different car brands.
Globally.
Yes, globally. Yeah. You know, there's also going to be the Audi Q4 e-tron coming next year, which is also on this. The ID Buzz. The microbus that's coming in 2022, also off this platform. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this, MEB, the default configuration is rear wheel drive, the electric motors at the rear axle.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things about the ID.4 and the ID.3 as well, there's no front trunk. Because what they did was they compressed that space in the front, you know, expanded out the passenger volume, shortened the front overhang. And, you know, so the front area, you know, is taken up just by like the climate control hardware. And on the all-wheel drive versions, the motor will be down there as well, the second motor. But, you know, the base, so they start sales. They hope to ship a few first edition models before the end of the year, but then, you know, really go on sale in the first quarter of next year. So the base rear wheel drive version, 201 horsepower, that 250 miles range, you know, which is not great, but, you know, better than what they got out of the Audi e-tron.
Well, right. And 250 miles is completely fabulous for most, for what people actually need to do with it. It's just psychologically, you know, that those mainstream people may not appreciate that.
And the all-wheel drive version is going to be 302 horsepower.
Yeah.
The design language that they've developed for their EVs, you know, the ID.3, this is, you know, very similar kind of look, you know, they're, you know, one of the things they mentioned, you know, is, you know, this transition from chrome to lighting on the front. You know, so you've got the signature lighting, you know, around the headlamps and across the front, and, you know, on some models, a backlit version of the BMW, the Volkswagen grille.
You know, I think it's a really nice looking vehicle.
Yeah, no, I do. I like it a lot. It's got a, you know, kind of a nice muscular athletic look to it, a nice stance to it. And I like, you know, the contrasting roof, you know, which is something we've talked about before.
Awesome. Yes.
You know, and then, you know, that base price of $40,000, there's two option packages available. If you load it up, you know, that gets you to $46,000. Actually, the best value, if you're interested in one of these, the best thing to do is actually get the first edition. Because the first edition, they didn't say how many there's going to be, you know, maybe a few thousand of these.
Okay.
But if you get the first edition, it actually, the two packages are the statement package and the gradient package. I have no idea why they named them the way they did, but that's what they are. The first edition actually includes everything that's in those two packages, except for the light up VW logo on badge on the hood on the front. So you get everything else that's in those two packages that normally cost $46,000 for $44,000. So okay. If you act now, you can save $2,000.
But wait, there's more. No. There is more. There, you get a $7,500 tax credit.
Yeah, you get the $7,500. If you're in California, you can get another $2,000, a couple of grand if you're in New Jersey. It's really good. Oh, and the other thing, they're including 3 years of unlimited DC fast charging at Electrify America stations.
Yes.
If you don't have a charger at home, you can go to an EA station, for the first 3 years and charge to your heart's content, fast charge. And, charge from 5% to 80%, take about 35, 38 minutes.
And I think they were showing the lease price. I think it was it $349?
$379.
And then they talked about the fact that what you're saving in gas, it basically will be $50 a month. If you subtract how much you're saving in gas, they don't go into what the cost is for the electricity, but it was
they estimate the gas savings compared to a Tiguan, which is their other compact utility, is going to be about $3,500
a year.
Over 5 years.
Over 5 years.
So okay. $750 a year in fuel savings. So $3,500, if you use Tesla math and you take that off, off the purchase price, now you're down to $29,000, starting price.
A really good deal.
Yeah. It's not cheap. It's certainly not, as inexpensive as, something like the base Ioniq or, the Crosstrek. But, it's also, it's getting into the heart of that market. The average transaction price on those competitive compact crossovers like the CRV and RAV4 and Escape, is in that low $30,000 range anyway. That's their average selling price for those. So you're gonna end up paying roughly the same, and you're not going to have any gas. And for the first 3 years, you may not even have to pay for electricity for it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I love the fact that, first of all, it's real.
Yes.
That it's not just a concept, but it looks like the kind of car that you would want to drive. It kind of almost reminds me of like a Mazda CX-5 or, it's a car that looks practical, but stylish, very urban, very modern. And yet it happens to be electric. As opposed to trying to force people into something weird, this looks like a car that just happens to be electric, and is good.
And, I think, the interior is definitely much more modern. This is an area where it's diverged from traditional VWs.
Nice.
The instrument cluster, it's a digital instrument cluster. It's a 5.3-inch display that's right in front of you. It has speed and things like that, some of your mode information. On the right-hand side of that is a toggle or a switch to rotate to shift from park to reverse and drive and neutral. And then there's a standard central display is a 10.2-inch display, and then optional is a 12-inch touchscreen display. All of the other controls on the steering wheel and on the dashboard are all touch controls, which I'm not crazy about. but it's going to be interesting. One thing that's interesting, it has gesture controls for the touchscreen, so you don't actually have to touch the screen.
So you don't have to.
You can swipe through the menus just by gesturing with your hand. We'll see how well that works. I think you still may have to actually touch it to activate the stuff on those menus, but you can swipe through. But you can also do a lot of stuff, or they say you'll be able to do a lot of stuff with the voice controls, which, much like a lot of, the other digital voice assistants around you, you can trigger that with Hey ID. And then it, you can control, climate control and audio and other things from that.
And one of the things that they talked about was it doesn't have a stop-start button.
Yes. When you get in, it's it just, you put it in drive and it goes, which is this actually the same as Tesla. Tesla doesn't have a stop start button either. You just put it in drive or reverse and you go.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
But you have to have the key. You have to have the key fob on you.
Okay.
During the call today, I asked a question. I'm not sure if they actually knew the answer to the question I was asking. But the question I was asking was about ultra wideband, which is a new wireless technology which debuted last fall on the new Golf that's available in Europe, which is not being sold here, and it's also on the ID3. They both have ultra wideband technology for the key fob, which is different from the traditional RF technology. So the way it works, it's much more secure and much faster to respond.
Interesting.
So when you walk up to the car, you can have the key fob in your pocket. And as you approach the car, it'll be able to unlock for you and you can get in. So, like a lot of others, but the way it works, I'm not going to go into all those details. I'll include a link to an article I wrote about that. And there's a good video with Lars Rieger, who's the CTO of NXP, who makes that ultra wideband chip. One of the cool things about that, if you have a recent iPhone, like an iPhone 11 and presumably other upcoming iPhones, there's a chip in there that they call the U1 chip, which is an ultra wideband chip. The new version of iOS and presumably in the not too distant future, Android and some Android phones will also have ultra wideband, allows you, the iOS 14 has support for a new standard called digital key. So you can actually use the ultra wideband chip that's in your phone. Once you pair your phone to the car, you can use that as your key.
That's cool.
You don't have to take your phone out. You don't have to unlock it. It's it's using a very secure communication system, and so you get it. You unlock the car, sit it, get inside, put it in drive, and go. Very quick, very responsive. So I'll link to that article in the show notes for this episode.
Cool. And then the other thing that they commented on was the wireless experience, where they're really trying to make the vehicle a fully wireless experience, including being able to use your phone with, my understanding, with Android and Apple CarPlay wirelessly.
Wireless Android Auto and CarPlay. And then, there's a standard Qi charging pad, wireless charging pad under the dash. So you can just put your phone down there. Don't have to plug it in. Don't have to touch anything. Should be very easy. And you also get 5 years of connected services with the car as well. So the first 5 years are complimentary.
No, I'm really excited for this. I'll be very, very interested to see what consumer response is on it as
well. Yeah, the ID3 has been getting pretty positive reviews in Europe since they started driving it a few weeks ago. So I'm looking forward to trying this one out.
For sure.
All right, let's hit a couple of listener emails and then call it a night.
Okay.
So first one is actually just a comment from Jerry Cox. Really enjoyed the podcast and have a question regarding noise and ride. Actually, it was another one that was a comment, but anyway, noise and ride. It's really important to me how a car takes the bumps and how much road noise makes it to the cabin. Can you provide the decibel rating at 65 to 70 miles an hour for the automobiles reviewed? Jerry, we'd love to.
Exactly.
If you will send us a sound meter, we would happily do that evaluation for you. Accurate sound meters are quite expensive. And you may have noticed that there's no ads on this show yet. We're not getting paid for it. So, anybody that wants to send us a sound meter, we will put it to good use. But unfortunately, right now, we don't have that equipment available to us. So we can't give you those numbers. Sorry.
But it's a great question, though. I love the question.
We
try as much as possible to talk about road noise and such.
Yeah, we try to give you our subjective evaluations. And when a car has a lot of road noise or a lot of engine noise, especially if it's an unpleasant sound, we do try to highlight that. Point it out. I don't know if I'd say highlight, but sometimes we highlight it. But we do try to give you an idea of what to expect from this car.
Yes.
So, all right. Next up, Robert Clark. I'm a pretty new listener, and I wanted to let you all know that I really appreciate the show. Unbiased, honest, and sincere reviews have impressed me. When I started listening, I expected you only to recommend high priced vehicles and put down affordable vehicles. You haven't done that. I've been impressed and pleased to hear the review and recommended vehicles of all price ranges. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. That's lovely.
Yes. That's the one that was the comment.
Yes.
And another one from Blake Swan, who we answered his questions last week, but he's got another one for us. Says, question for you, do you find Lexus relevant anymore when Genesis is offering new rear-wheel drive-based SUVs and cars, and even Lincoln is offering rear drive-based SUVs, Corsair aside? I just feel like the RX has only gotten uglier and heavier as time has gone on, while keeping the V6, the 3.5-liter V6 as a staple. Surely someone will catch on and realize the new RAV4 is better in almost all areas than the NX, based on the prior-gen RAV4 still. Looking at the 21 Lexus IS, whatever with its second refresh, does Lexus Toyota care? The flagship LC500 being the lone exception. Even their sports cars, they pay someone else to make them, are half-hearted. The new Z looks to be everything the Supra should have been and sadly isn't. What do you think? Is Lexus relevant?
Well, you know, I think we talked about this actually last week when we were going over the LC500 that I had, because it's such a fantastic vehicle. It's a really good example of what Lexus could still be. The brand itself has been living off of the spoils of the baby boomers for so many decades, really since it started, right? Like, so it started in the mid 80s, right at the time when the oldest baby boomers were moving into peak earning years and they wanted to buy luxury products. They were, you know, dedicated to Toyota and they wanted something more luxurious. So Lexus was created, the same reason Infiniti and Acura was created at the same time. But I think that Lexus has, they were so invested in the RX. That was their bread and butter for decades. And now the people that bought the RX are empty nesters and retiring. And they're just, you know, they're not buying things like the LC500. So I think that Lexus is struggling to kind of stay relevant in this marketplace that has so many different demographics in it and so many different cohorts. And when you think about the millennials, that, you know, they grew up with Lexus and they are not going to buy what their parents bought. So I think Blake has a point. I understand his concern for sure, because I do think that Lexus is kind of struggling.
I agree. You know, trying to figure out what they want to be going forward. Yeah, and I think this, you know, this is a challenge for any brand, is, you know, trying to understand, you know, what it wants to be, what it wants to represent, and who it wants to appeal to. And, you know, for something like Lexus, you know, which started off as, you know, this epitome of refinement and quality, you know, is that, you know, when everything, you know, has gotten so good, you know, including, you know, Toyota vehicles, you know, that are made by the same manufacturer, and in some cases, you know, in the same plants, you know, is there, you know, what's the place of Lexus anymore?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and one of the things I would encourage manufacturers to do is as they're designing the product, to not design for their audience today, but to look out 7 years. Who is in the marketplace? How are they different than people that are in the marketplace today? And that's a key thing of, like, of some of the work that I've done in the past, understanding the core values, understanding the growing up experience, understanding, you know, how growing up experiences have impacted the people that are coming into the marketplace and those enduring mindsets. And I think that Lexus really, I think that they've struggled a bit in that, in evolving. And you're always going to go through waves, you know, in of popularity and such. But I think that you know, they are vulnerable to being taken over by even a brand like Lincoln that has great product, because at the end of the day, it does always start and end with product. The marketing needs to enhance that and needs to clarify and confirm that product, but you can't sell a product that isn't good. And I think that, you know, and not to say Lexus isn't good, but, you know, you've got to sell a product that you believe in. And I think that Lexus has good product, but it's not as exciting, perhaps. And it may be a little bit more staid than, and hasn't stayed as relevant, even though they could. You know, there is, I think the LC500 shows that there is passion there and there is capability there. And look, you know, they have done some great things with Toyota. So it's there, it's in their wheelhouse. I think they just haven't really been able to execute as well. And I have to laugh. Blake says, I'm a senior financial analyst who also was an auditor in a prior life. Just an FYI, Blake, I used to work for the FDIC and I closed banks and I have an accounting degree. So when we talk about people that are in the financial field, we do, because he says something about so don't think finance people don't enjoy splurging on fun cars. I would assure you that my FDIC background has not hindered my ability to enjoy fun cars.
Yeah. And, you know, with reference to Genesis, you know, which is part of the original question, you know, while, you know, we have been, you know, we've praised Genesis vehicles profusely over the last several years, you know, the reality is, you know, that Genesis, as good as we think their cars are, is still very much, you know, I would grade them an incomplete.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, they haven't really been able to get sales ramped up. You know, they haven't been able to get the market really excited about it yet.
Well, first of all, it's product, right? They're the GV80 we're still waiting. We saw it. It's still not out yet though. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have an SUV in their lineup. They started with two sedans. Sedans are fantastic in the Korean market. They are not appropriate in the US market. And the dealer network, ironically, since we talked at length about dealers, their franchise, they had all sorts of fits and starts with how they were going to roll out this brand. So they really didn't have the right product to start with. Even though it's really good, it's not, people aren't buying sedans.
It's not the right product for this market at this time.
It's not the right product, exactly. And then you couple that with the disruption that they had with their dealer network. Who was going to get them? Some dealers weren't going to be getting a Genesis. First, they wanted separate showrooms, which was very, very expensive, as we talked about earlier. And then they said, okay, well, only a certain number of dealers were going to get them. And then that pissed off other dealers. And it just was this kind of escalation. Now they've actually lost some very good senior people. So Manfred Fitzgerald who was the CEO and oversaw some of the development of a number of these vehicles. He is gone. Luke, whose last name you know how to pronounce. Thank you. He has left the company as well. And Luke actually oversaw a lot of the design of these really good products. Sung Yip, one of his colleagues, is still there and will carry on that vision. But you know, they also lost a fantastic young designer who did some really cool concepts for them. So there is disruption there. They have lost some people that kind of had that stabilized the vision, and now those people have moved on. So it's definitely a company in transition. We'll see where they end up.
Yeah, it's. I hope they succeed. You know, because
absolutely
they've done some great products, and they've got more coming. So
absolutely,
it's going to be a challenge. I mean, it's always a challenge getting a new brand up and running, just as it's a challenge perpetuating an old brand. You know, it's not easy to keep a brand relevant. You know, Cadillac has struggled with it. You know, Lincoln struggled with it for a long time. They seem to have found their way in recent years, to a large degree. But you know, even that, you know, we'll see if they can keep that going, keep that momentum going.
Right, because the product for Lincoln is there, but and sales are improving for sure. But I do still think that they still have a lot of work to do.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for your letters. Keep them coming in. We love having that stuff to talk about. You know, if you like what you hear, you know, give us a rating somewhere on Apple Podcasts or whatever, you know, whatever you listen to. And if you happen to be an Amazon Music listener, Wheel Bearings is now available in the podcast section on Amazon Music.
I didn't even know that.
It just launched. It just launched recently, and I made sure to get the show in there. And
that's amazing.
It's also on Spotify if you listen to podcasts there, and then you know whatever podcatcher you use. There's links to all that stuff on wheelbearings.media. Just click on the at the top of the page on the subscribe to the show. You'll find links to a bunch of the most popular podcast players and services where you can find us.
Yep, and follow us on Twitter, and all good things. And Dan will probably be back with us next week, unless he gets trapped under something heavy.
We'll see. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Right,
thanks, everyone. Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.